It is Wednesday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders and Republican businessman Donald Trump win the presidential primaries in New Hampshire. The director of U.S. National Intelligence tells a congressional panel about his security concerns about North Korea. An analyst tells us Pyongyang's threat is growing.
That then shows to me that they are absolutely bent on very quickly developing the capability to threaten a large radius of countries around the Pacific Rim.
And the former London residence of musician Jimi Hendrix is now a musician. It's all ahead. Vermont Democratic Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Republican billionaire businessman Donald Trump emerged as the respective winners in the New Hampshire state presidential primary election on Tuesday. Sanders handily defeated former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton 60-38% and said his victory sent a message to the nation.
Together, we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California. And that is that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs.
Meanwhile, Trump bested the other eight Republican hopefuls, taking 35% of the vote, with Ohio Governor John Kasich coming in a distant second at 16%. Trump, speaking to his supporters, took aim at Sanders for wanting to give the country away, and while congratulating him, said he won't let that happen.
We are going to make America great again, but we're going to do it the old-fashioned way. We're going to beat China, Japan. We're going to beat Mexico at trade. We're going to beat all of these countries that are taking so much of our money away from us on a daily basis. It's not going to happen anymore. We are going to do something so good and so fast and so strong, and the world is going to respect us again. Believe me.
Most presidential candidates over the past 60 years who won New Hampshire went on to win the White House in the November election. However, there are notable exceptions. Presidents Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton all lost in the tiny New England state and still won the White House. I'm joined now by VOA's Bill Gallo, who's in New Hampshire. Bill, let's start with the Democrats. The Sanders defeat of Hillary Clinton, that must be pretty devastating for the Clinton team.
Yeah, it really was. You know, in the days leading up to the vote, Clinton had hoped to at least narrow the gap. She was always behind in the polls here by a quite large margin, at least for the last several weeks. But there had been some hope that she would close the gap and at least finish this within perhaps maybe single digits. She didn't. And now it appears that Sanders is a real threat to Clinton moving forward.
Well, now, Sanders is from the neighboring state of Vermont, so that must have given him somewhat of an edge. But the success of his campaign so far, what message is the Democratic electorate sending to Washington?
Well, it really appears to have moved very far to the left. I don't think there's really any question on that. And last night, Sanders won here in almost every demographic, every age group. It was a pretty firm message that it's moved far to the left, and let's see how Clinton will adapt to that moving forward.
Okay. Well, now turning to the Republicans, why did Trump succeed? And this is in spite of the fact he's run a very controversial campaign so far.
Right. Well, you know, I think there was some emphasis this time on a ground game. In Iowa, he kind of just expected to do well since he was doing well in the polls, and I think that he took it for granted that people would show up to vote. There was much more of an emphasis on, hey, you know, I know you support me, I know we're doing well in the polls, but you have to actually vote. And they did this time. So it really appears that all those questions about whether Trump supporters would really show up to vote, they did last night, and resoundingly.
Well, now, what about Kasich coming in second in the Republican contest? Was that a surprise?
Well, you know, he had put all of his eggs in the New Hampshire basket, you could say. He really focused on New Hampshire, and he had to do well here. He had hinted that he was going to drop out if he didn't. He did do pretty well. He got 16%. It was a distant second-place finish, but it's good enough for him to continue. And it's anyone's guess as to what it looks like going forward, whether he will be one of those, you know, several mainstream, more establishment Republican candidates who will make a challenge for this.
All right. Well, my thanks to VOA's Bill Gallo, who's in Manchester, New Hampshire. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks, Sarah.
Jeffrey Skelling, associate editor of the Sabato Crystal Ball, a website at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Sanders win is astounding against what is still presumed to be the eventual Democratic nominee.
Not only did he win, he won basically by the upper limit of what people could have expected, perhaps even exceeded it. Hillary Clinton is actually below where she finished in 2008. And that's pretty remarkable, given that it was more or less a three-way race in 2008, where she won just shy of 40% of the vote to win the New Hampshire primary. There's a regional factor in that, and Sanders is from right next door. But still, nonetheless, 6-7 months ago, if you told us that Bernie Sanders would be in a position to win 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, I think most of us would have probably chuckled at the idea.
Does this say more about Hillary Clinton than it does Bernie Sanders?
It was probably always somewhat hopeless for her to imagine that she would have a completely unfettered, easy ride to the nomination, just simply because she has not had a strong history on the campaign trail. She is very close to Wall Street, or at least has been historically, and that is a major issue for a lot of liberals right now. You know, you have to give him some credit here, too, in the sense that it's not just that Hillary Clinton hasn't been as strong as she might have hoped. Sanders has proven to be much stronger than a lot of people would have expected.
Jeffrey, there are a number of reports out there that former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg may enter the race as an independent. If he does, or somebody else looks at these results and decides on the Democratic side to jump in, how will that change the race?
Well, if Michael Bloomberg runs as an independent, that will be very bad news for Democrats, because while it's very difficult to believe that Bloomberg would be able to do well or even be close to winning, there's a long track record in this country of third-party independent candidates failing, having perhaps some bright moments when they were leading the polls, but in the end, a lot of voters end up coming home to their respective parties.
On the Republican side, what does this mean for Donald Trump and for Governor John Kasich?
For Donald Trump, the answer is pretty easy. He's won this, and now he's actually got a win under his belt. For Kasich, he's going to take this second-place win and use it as a ticket to keep on riding the campaign trail. You know, I'm not going to say this is a means to him winning the nomination or anything, but he's going to be able to stay in the fight and probably raise some more money because of it. And voters are going to give him a second look. I mean, that's really what New Hampshire is doing for a lot of these candidates. For Kasich, I think, and Sanders particularly, that they're going to get second looks.
That's Jeffrey Skelling of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Skelling also says an interesting footnote to the election is that for the first time in New Hampshire, at least five candidates finished in double digits, suggesting a very fractured electorate. Candidates who remain in the race will now turn their attention to the next contests in Nevada and South Carolina later this month. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, how's social media responding to all this today?
Well, as we often see after these primaries, there's a lot of what we will call, I guess, Wednesday morning quarterbacking.
Yeah.
A lot of the supporters trying to spin the results in their favor. So I want to look at the two different sides and look at some of what social media is saying. On the Democratic side, of course, Bernie Sanders' unexpected blowout of Hillary Clinton, although Hillary Clinton's supporters on social media are saying it was expected because he is the senator from the neighboring state of Vermont. But I thought it was interesting, too, that Bernie Sanders has such a strong base of young people, and they're very active in social media. So a lot of people pointing to that as a key element of his campaign and suggesting that that was something that helped him prevail. And Hillary Clinton actually alluded to this last night in her concession speech, people pointing out on social media. She said, "I know I have a lot of work to do, especially with young people." So that seems to be kind of a way to address Bernie Sanders' success with young people, with those who are using social media and having this great base of support there. On the Republican side, a lot of people surprised, not necessarily by Donald Trump's win. He was leading in the polls, but a new side that he's showing. He congratulated his opponents and, you know, wished them well. People saying he looked a lot more presidential. And this is something that he said on the campaign trail, that he would try to become more presidential if he was elected. He wouldn't have all this bluster that he usually does, which social media usually seizes on and loves to talk about all of that.
And insults as well.
Exactly. And for Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, an interesting soundbite from him, a lot of people sharing, where he said, "I had a poor debate performance on Saturday. This defeat coming in fifth place is on me. I apologize. It won't happen again." That debate moment where he kind of repeated the same line several times over and over again just kind of got pilloried in social media. There were fake accounts, Marco Roboto, they were calling him because he was so robotic. But it's interesting how some of that debate moment that kind of blew up over the weekend on social media might have actually caused him to slip in the polls and fall into fifth place. Mm-hmm. Also trending today, other than politics, there are other things going on around the world, is hashtag Ash Wednesday. Of course, this is the start of Lent for Christians around the world. So there's some interesting things people are sharing, what they're giving up for Lent. That's the traditional thing, you give something up. So people saying, "Oh, I'm giving up sweets or chocolate," but then you have the jokesters that are saying, "I'm going to give up going to the gym." And then part of Ash Wednesday is abstaining from eating for fasting, but also abstaining from meat. So people are posting a lot of fish dishes, whether it's recipes or pictures of fish, so as people kick off the Lenten season. So a nice way for Christians around the world to kind of connect on social media, something that was maybe just something you'd experience within your church, is now connecting people around the world.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A multidisciplinary team of researchers that included scientists and historians have discovered a new extraordinary and extended period of cooling in the Northern Hemisphere between 536 to about 660 A.D., called the Late Antique Little Ice Age, the researchers found that it appears to play a role in one of the most tempestuous periods of world history. Michael McCormick, a professor of medieval history at Harvard University, says that the cooling period was good for some and not so good for others.
You have the Roman Empire undergoing very serious stress, and then starting in the 630s and 640s, to the extraordinary overnight growth of the Arab early Islamic empire.
The researchers were able to reconstruct summer temperatures over the past 2,000 years by studying tree rings. The climate data was then compared with a historical record of the time. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the former London flat of Jimi Hendrix is now a museum. We'll have a visit. The U.S. Senate is considering new sanctions on North Korea following Pyongyang's latest satellite launch Sunday. A vote on North Korea's Sanctions and Policy Enhancement Act on Wednesday aims to expand and tighten economic restrictions by blocking the North's access to hard currency. The House of Representatives passed similar legislation last month. In his annual assessment to Congress on security threats faced by the United States, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said the North has expanded a uranium enrichment facility and restarted a plutonium reactor. Here are excerpts from the Clapper testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee Tuesday.
Violent extremists are operationally active in about 40 countries. 7 countries are experiencing a collapse of central government authority. 14 others face regime-threatening or violent instability or both. Another 59 countries face a significant risk of instability through 2016. Technological innovation during the next few years will have an even more significant impact on our way of life. This innovation is central to our economic prosperity, but it will bring new security vulnerabilities. Russia and China continue to have the most sophisticated cyber programs. Iran and North Korea continue to conduct cyber espionage as they enhance their attack capabilities. Turning to terrorism, there are now more Sunni violent extremist groups, members, and safe havens than at any time in history. ISIL, including its 8 established and several more emerging branches, has become the preeminent global terrorist threat. Although the U.S. is a much harder target than Europe, ISIL external operations remain a critical factor in our threat assessments for 2016.
That's James Clapper, the director of U.S. National Intelligence. And the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Vincent Stewart, told lawmakers North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs remain a continuing threat as it diversifies its missile force and nuclear delivery options. Retired Air Force intelligence officer and now global risk management consultant Cedric Layton tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this represents a huge security concern.
What it shows is not only are the North Koreans bent on creating not only the technology but also the actual weapon systems for a true nuclear power, they are bent on projecting that power. So you couple the plutonium developments with their efforts to miniaturize warheads, and then you couple those two developments with the test of the rocket. That then shows to me that they are absolutely bent on very quickly developing the capability to threaten a large radius of countries around the Pacific Rim.
Clapper also said in his testimony that Kim Jong-un's regime continues to develop cyber espionage and cyber attack capabilities and has sold illegal weapons technology to other states.
There are a lot of instances where there is at least circumstantial evidence that North Korea has sold weapons technology to other states. There's also a lot of evidence that there is a cooperation arrangement between countries such as North Korea and Iran. And there is a high level of confidence out there that Iranian personnel may have been present at the latest North Korean rocket launch. So on that side, you know, they're definitely working in the direction of proliferating weapons of mass destruction. On the cyber front, it is very clear that the North Koreans were testing their capabilities against Sony Pictures when they conducted that hack. That particular incident was a situation where, for the first time, a nation state took the capability that they had and tried to censor a film in a third country. And that is something that is a very dangerous development. And it really shows the idea that the North Koreans will try this again.
Well, President Obama on Tuesday unveiled a cybersecurity national action plan as Mr. Clapper warned of growing risks from new technologies that open more doors to hackers.
The president is going in the right direction. We have to do a lot more than what we've been doing before in the cybersecurity realm. It becomes very important for us to shore up our cyber defenses, and the government has to lead the way. It has taken too long for the government to act, but this is definitely a welcome first step.
That's retired Air Force intelligence officer and now global risk management consultant Cedric Layton. President Obama said the $19 billion Cybersecurity National Action Plan is aimed at modernizing federal IT by replacing systems, some of which date to the 1960s, that are vulnerable to attack. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Fans of the late Jimi Hendrix will now get to see life as he lived it while in London. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the apartment where Hendrix and his former girlfriend lived has been restored and open as a museum.
Jimi Hendrix and his girlfriend Kathy Etchingham lived in the top floor flat of an 18th century house in London's Mayfair neighborhood in 1968 and 69. Now, their former apartment has been faithfully restored to show what life was like for the guitar genius at the height of his career. Persian rugs are on the floor, a Victorian shawl hangs above the bed, and a clamshell ashtray sits on a nightstand. Another room has a wall of album covers, including Hendrix's Are You Experienced, his first album with drummer Mitch Mitchell and bass player Noel Redding. Some of Hendrix's own collection, including a copy of Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, stained with the guitarist's own blood, are also on display. Dr. Christian Lloyd is a professor at Queen's University and the author of a new book, Hendrix at Home, A Blues Man in Mayfair. He says Hendrix had the advantage of having no neighbors when he rented the flat, so he could make music at high volume if he wanted to.
One of the great advantages of living here was that there were no neighbours. It wasn't really a residential street at that time. So you could play music as loud as you liked, and they did. I think it was a kind of place where, after they'd been to the speakeasy, so one of the music clubs, just 5 or 10 minutes walk away, they'd come back here later and hang out and so on. So, yeah, Jimmy was 25 when he was here. So, yeah, they had some fun, yeah.
The display also features Jimi Hendrix's acoustic guitar, an Epiphone FT-79, which was always within arm's reach.
That guitar was always leaned up against the bed there. It was always within hand's reach. He composed many of his most famous songs on that guitar, not on an electric guitar, actually. And she said, he'd play and play and play. You know, people think of Hendrix as a genius. He was also someone who worked really, really hard on his music.
The apartment at 23 Brook Street is next to the former house of composer George Friedrich Handel. It was originally office space for the Handel House Museum, but so many people visited Hendrix's old apartment that a temporary exhibition was mounted 5 years ago. That was such a success that museum directors decided to open a permanent exhibition in the flat. Barry Wenzel is a former photographer for Melody Maker magazine who photographed Jimi Hendrix in the flat in the 1960s. Some of his images are on display in the exhibit. He says he thinks that Jimmy would be pleased.
Every time I hear that, Hey Joe on the radio, I'm back in the darkroom again. The music and the pictures are on mnemonic to bring you back into that. And I think it's very important for the younger generation who don't know that world of freedom and hippiness and money wasn't an issue. And hey, you walk down the street and there's Jimmy Page or Richie Blackmore, or you go to the speakeasy and there's Keith Moon destroying somebody's drum and drinking somebody to the floor in the bar.
The Jimi Hendrix House Museum opens to the public February 10th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Hey, Joe. Where you going with that?
Jimi Hendrix. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a rising tide of religious persecution emerging worldwide, and it disproportionately threatens religious minority groups. This threat touches Christians in the Middle East, Yazidis in Iraq, Baha'is in Iran, Hindus in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims in India, or Sunni Muslims in Shia areas, or vice versa. The threat, said Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South and Central Asia, Knox Thames, is clear and present. Terrorists and non-state actors such as ISIL, the Nusra Front, and Al-Qaeda are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities. But individual attackers have also perpetrated acts of violence against religious minorities. And unfortunately, in far too many places, governments continue to limit the exercise of religious freedoms. Protecting and promoting the universal right to freedom of religion is central to American foreign policy. Not only is it the right thing to do, said Special Advisor Knox, it is a smart thing to do as it plays a major role in contributing to more stable, progressive, and dynamic societies. Wherever people face religious persecution, the United States is at work finding ways to help. For example, the U.S. pressures governments to enact reforms so that religious minorities are able to freely practice their faith. Militarily, through airstrikes, the U.S. is providing protection for minority religions to remain in their ancestral homeland. The U.S. continues to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians and Iraqis, including refugees and displaced populations, and supports resettlement for those who cannot safely return home. The U.S. is encouraging countries in the Middle East to support, through education, respect for human rights and religious freedom. Governments in the region are also being urged to take steps to protect religious minorities during holy days and religious gatherings. The United States, said President Barack Obama, will continue to work with a broad coalition against those who have subjected religious minorities to unspeakable violence and persecution. All people deserve the fundamental dignity of practicing their faith free from fear, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.